Good morning, everybody. What a privilege to be here again. We're preaching through Ruth. Four chapters, a little story that kind of weaves our lives into the big story that God is telling. So I want to read just a few verses to you, which I want to take as the foundation for what I want to preach this morning. Ruth chapter 1, verse 19 to 21 from the ESV. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they'd come to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman said, "It's Naomi." And she said to them, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi, which means sweet, when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" Life almost never turns out the way we dream it will. Naomi married Elimelech as a young woman, and she dreamed of marriage and raising children and having grandchildren on her knee, building a home, and living a full life. She never signed up for what ended up happening to her. It was an unexpected hairpin bend in her life's journey, which she didn't navigate very well. We don't tend to navigate these hairpin bends in life very well because it's not what we expect. Very few people end up living the life they dream of living when they're young. Life's just not like that. You see, Elimelech, she had two kids, two boys. Life had started. Everything was peachy. Her marriage was peachy. Her kids were peachy. Two boys. And all of a sudden, a famine hits, and her husband, Elimelech, which means God is king, and yet he lived like God was dead. Elimelech decided, they become economic migrants, and off they go to Moab, where there's food. He leaves his Jewish culture. He leaves and rebels against everything God ever instructed the Jewish nation to be and do. And he transports his family, his wife and his two boys, into Moab, an idol-worshipping, rebellious, product of incest nation. And there he thinks he'll find the white picket fence and the green lawn. They've left famine behind, and now we're going to live in this land of provision. And then he dies. And now Naomi is left a widow. And her sons end up marrying Moabite women. You know, that's like your good Christian boys marrying an ISIS leader. That's not what you dreamed would happen to your kids. That they'd go off and marry Moabitesses. That's not supposed to happen to good Jewish boys. Things very quickly unravel for Naomi. And then her sons die. How much can go wrong in one person's life? How much tragedy can one person live with? So we have three widows, childless, in a foreign country where God is not worshipped. She's away from her culture, from her language, from her people, and mostly from the God she grew up serving and worshipping. Devastated. And in 10 short years, this Naomi, who was sweet, unravels into being a bitter old widow because life's not fair.
Good, Andy.
And she decides, I'm going to go back to Bethlehem. She hears there's food there, and she manages to convince Orpah, one of her daughters-in-law, to leave and go back to her people and her gods and her family and maybe marry again. But you know, Ruth totally and absolutely refuses, and she says, "Your people will be my people, your land my land, your God my God. Where you die, I will die." And Naomi gives up trying to convince her to stay, because you see, Ruth has run into this covenantal God that Naomi grew up worshiping. And they make the journey back to Bethlehem. You see, the natural consequence of life is we grow bitter and hard. Because the dreams we had as young people just almost never fulfill. And when they do, they always come in some strange way. It's just natural. It's not natural to grow up getting sweeter and sweeter the older you get. How many sweet, sweet old people have you met? Most of the old people I've met are just grumpy. Like they've constantly got fleas in their hair or something's chewing their backside. It's not normal to grow up getting sweeter and sweeter. And why is it that we get grumpier the older we become? You know what happens to people who end up bitter with God? Because that was Naomi's problem. She was bitter and angry towards God. She left Bethlehem full. She left Bethlehem with two boys and a husband. And she comes back with nothing. She had no money. She had no grandchildren. She had no sons. She had one daughter-in-law who was a Moabitess. And she lands up back in Bethlehem with nothing. And she says, "Don't call me sweet. I'm no longer sweet. The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." The consequences of bitterness towards God, because your life doesn't turn out the way you imagined it would. Your prayers seemingly aren't answered. The dreams and visions you think God gave you when you were young just haven't materialized. What happens to Naomi? Her bitterness shrinks her world, and she slips into a depression that causes her to just die. No longer is she a scheming, active, engaged woman. She's a bitter old widow Jewess. And her life shrinks and collapses in on itself. And she becomes just another casualty of life. Because I think if we read the rest of the story, because thankfully that's not the way it ends. We're not left there. And I'm not going to leave you there. She suddenly realizes, in the midst of her bitterness and anger towards God, she realizes, I think, three things. She realizes God is kind. She realizes that in all of life, God faithfully provides. And she learns through experience that God is absolutely sovereign. And if you're looking for a cure for your bitterness and anger towards God, my prayer is this morning that you'd see the kindness, goodness, provision, and sovereignty of our Father, and that your bitterness would flow away. And where bitterness may have incapacitated you and shrunk your world into a small, inactive, non-contributory, dying world, your bitterness would give way to a sweetness again as it did in Naomi's life. And this old, bitter Jewish woman turns into this incredibly scheming mother-in-law. And the plans of God unfold before her. That's how I want to grow old. Not getting grumpier and more bitter, because life didn't turn out for me the way I wanted it. And I bet you your life hasn't turned out for you the way you thought it would. I very seldom meet somebody whose whole life has just been peachy until the grave. And that's just not the way it works. You see, crisis, difficulty, struggle, trial, tribulation, suffering reveals the most important thing about us, what we believe about God. That's the single most important thing that you and I live with, is what we believe about the nature and character of God. And crisis revealed this in Naomi's life. And I think if I look at Scripture, I see three possible responses to this bitterness. The Almighty has dealt harshly with me. Do you remember Job's wife's advice in Job's situation? What did Job's wife say to him? Curse God and die. That's one way to respond. You could respond now like Naomi did. You acknowledge his almightiness, but his almightiness has only ever meant your destruction. It's only ever meant that everything, my fullness has disappeared, it's evaporated. There's no way forward. I'm depressed. I'm withdrawn. I give up on life and I sink into smallness and a terrible bitterness and hardness of heart towards him. Or you can be like Paul, who said in Romans 8:28, all things work together for the good. All things work together for the good. So are you going to curse God and die? Are you going to sink into smallness and bitterness? Or are you going to, like Paul, embrace a kind, providing, and sovereign God and say and sing and pray and celebrate all things work together for the good? I mean, just think of some stories. You know the story of Joseph, a young boy. Dreams, wild dreams. He's going to lead one day. And his brothers are insanely jealous. And they decide to kill him. Can you imagine? His brothers decide to kill him because they're so jealous of his dreams and his optimism and his... I mean, he was a little arrogant, let's be honest. He must have been an annoying younger brother. And they decide they're going to kill him, and so they take him off. And they throw him down a deep pit, and then suddenly they see financial advantage coming their way, and the economics of selling him as a slave to people traffickers catches their attention, and they do that. And off he goes with a bunch of people traffickers to be sold on a slave market to Potiphar. I mean, that's a hairpin bend in life, if ever there was one. Unexpected. David didn't wake up thinking, that's what I dream my life's going to be like, did he? But his good character and his faith in God sustains him in Potiphar's house, and he's hugely rewarded. And Potiphar blesses him. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, without any warning, falsely accused of rape by Potiphar's wife. Falsely accused of rape by Potiphar's wife. Wife. Not her husband, jeez. That would have been something else. And he lands up in a dark dungeon for years, not just a night. There was no bail application and no possibility of release for years. Shut in a dungeon, falsely accused of rape. And then there's a glimmer of hope. One of the friends he's in prison with gets released and promises to remind the people outside and score his release for him. And at the moment that baker's gone, he's forgotten Joseph. And there he sits, the guy on the outside, completely forgotten about him. And even in prison, this man's faith in a sovereign, kind, and providing God does not fail. You know, I've often said Joseph was like a bubble. No matter where you put him, it always found the highest point. You can take a bubble down to the deepest, darkest ocean in a bucket. It'll always be at the top of the bucket. That's what faith is like. Bubbles don't sink. And Joseph didn't sink. His faith sustained him. And then overnight, he ends up the vice president of Egypt. And you know what he says to his brothers who end up coming begging him for bread, unknowing that that's Joseph standing before them. He says to them, after they discover who he is, "As for you, you meant it evil for evil against me. But God meant it for good." God meant it. God meant it. God wasn't some impotent bystander to these tragic events unfolding in Joseph's life. God meant it. God planned it. God was actively engaged with what was going on. He wasn't like a watchmaker who wound up the watch and put it down and walked off and let the watch run down. He was intimately involved in the details of what was happening in Joseph's life, and he meant it for good. And he ended up saving nations and preserving the line of Jesus. For good, he meant it. And Joseph saw that. And that's how he... What about Moses? Moses, drawn out of a river, saved from certain death, and grows up in the wealthiest, most privileged home in the world at the time. And then on one day in his life, one unfortunate day in his life, he ends up in a moment doing something that causes him to have to run for his life. And he runs. And for 40 years, he lives on the backside of a desert, raising sheep, forgotten seemingly by men, forgotten by God. This man who grew up in this intense privilege with this phenomenal education and all this wealth, for 40 years on the backside of a desert, forgotten, gone, lost. And then in a moment of time at a burning bush, this man becomes one of the most important figures in all of human history. What about David? Young, handsome, full of dreams, anointed unexpectedly as king, and from that moment on, he's a refugee, running, hiding in caves, constantly worrying that his life will be taken from him by a jealous king, Saul. The prophets, they all were stoned and died for preaching God's word. John the Baptist lost his head for being uncompromising in righteousness. All the apostles were martyred, save John. Stephen, stoned. You see, life is messy. For a short moment on a Sunday morning, things seem fine. There's order. We sing in harmony. We pray together. We forget for a moment. And then there's this short journey between pulpit and the back of the tent there, just a few hundred meters. And in that short journey, we make this disordered re-entry into a world which just seems completely incongruent with God's salvation story. We leave this place and we enter this world of muddled marriages, chaotic cities, political strife, hot-headed, irrational students, midlife boredom, adolescent confusion, ethical ambiguity, racial tension, emotional distress. Over coffee at the back, you find yourself speaking to a husband whose wife left him for another woman. A parent whose teen stands next to them, sullen and angry. A man who, after many years of faithful service, has lost his job and now finds himself unemployed and basically unemployable. Maybe a grieving parent. Just a few steps away from the pulpit and this place of harmony and agreement and celebration of rescue and victory, we find ourselves in this world which seems like it's a different planet. But that's where you and I live. And that's where Ruth was written. Ruth is a good story for the parking lot and Monday mornings. It was written in the time of the judges, where every man did what he felt was fit. It was a chaotic time. Completely and utterly chaotic. And this little story, four chapters, was written in that most chaotic time in Israel's history. It was a nation in turmoil. And in the midst of that turmoil, there's this incredibly sweet story of God's kindness and sovereignty in two women and a farmer's life. There's no outstanding personality in this book. There are no splendid kings. There's no charismatic judge. There's no fiery prophet. It's a plain story about widows and a farmer, and how their lives, taken by God, are woven into a tapestry which ends up telling salvation's story, just like he wants to use you and me. The great names of the climactic scenes of the Sinai desert when the covenant was given, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, none of them are here. And sometimes you might find and think to yourself, you know, where would my place be in such a star-studded story? I'm just an ordinary, inconspicuous, inconsequential individual, disqualified by my own guilt and sin and my lack of flamboyant giftedness, and I have no magnetic personality. Where are my lines in this incredible story that God is telling me? Well, I tell you, if there's one thing Ruth tells me, is we all have lines in this story. God has a story to tell, and he doesn't just use Moses and Joshua. He used Ruth, the outsider, Moabites. Because life is a narrative. It's a story. You know, when Israel wrote history, they didn't write like their neighbors did. Their neighbor's history was just data. Their neighbor's history was a record of who ruled when, which battles were won, which agreements were struck, what transactions transpired between them. it was simply just factual data. And that's what most of what's how most of us perceive history. When Israel wrote history, their history was completely different because their history was a story of God's involvement in their lives, all of their lives. Righteousness and sin, rebellion and obedience, prayer and worship and running away. All of Israel's history was a story of God's involvement. That's history, and that's your and my story. It's narrative. Ruth doesn't contain any weighty concepts of Old Covenant law. It's just simply a story about you and me and where we find our place. But you see, what happens is if we get stuck where Naomi was in bitterness and anger towards God, which is everyone's temptation as we get older, then the lines we're supposed to say, the part we're supposed to play, ends up having to be passed on to somebody else because our worlds will shrink and become small. And we'll fail to dream and be the part, the person, and speak the lines that God has given us for this story. Because you know the story of Ruth. This outside Moabite Tess ends up becoming the mother of the man who ends up being the grandfather of David, who ends up being the line of Jesus. This Moabite Tess ends up being in Jesus' genealogy. Isn't that God's genius? You see, Ruth finds herself back in Bethlehem, the poorest of the poor. She gleans in the field. You didn't glean in a field if you weren't the poorest of the poor who had nothing. She had nothing except an amazing amount of intuition and hard work and initiative. And she finds herself gleaning in the field of this man, Boaz, a widowed, vulnerable outsider in a Jewish man's field, begging for the scraps that are left. Ruth 2, then Boaz spoke to Ruth. Boaz is the owner of this field. Speaks to Ruth, listen, my daughter, from now on, don't go to any other field to glean. Stay right here in this one and stay close to my young woman. Watch where they are harvesting and follow them. Don't worry about a thing. I've given orders to my servants not to harass you. When they get thirsty, when you get thirsty, feel free. Go drink from the water buckets the servants have filled. And she dropped to her knees, Ruth. She dropped to her knees. Can you picture this? She dropped to her knees. She bowed her face to the ground. How does this happen that you should pick me out and treat me so kindly? Me, a foreigner. That you should pick me out. That you, God's picked you out. You just happened to find yourself in this field, 3CI. And you find yourself in the field of this Boaz, who's Jesus. And he's picked you out to be kind to you, to care for you, to provide for you, to be sovereign of your life, to tell his story. Ruth goes home to Naomi, and Naomi said to her daughter-in-law in 2:20, may he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. And you know, that single phrase by Naomi is was what completely transformed her life. Up until that point, she was this bitter, twisted, old Jewish widowed mother-in-law, sitting at home in a shrunken world, thinking no further than her next meal. The moment Ruth comes back and tells her the story of Boaz's kindness towards her, Ruth's whole heart opens up and she suddenly realizes, God is here. He has provided Boaz. You found yourself in this field, and Boaz happens to be a kinsman redeemer. You found yourself in this field, and our heavenly Boaz, Jesus, looks upon you with kindness and says, I'll provide for you. I'll care for you. And that changed Naomi's life. Because from that moment on, she started to scheme how to arrange this wedding between Ruth and Boaz that ended up being in the genealogy of Jesus. You see, Galatians 4 says, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman. Loved by Jesus, loved by Boaz, God's sovereign providence. Who are you in this story? Well, we are Ruth, the Moabitess, the outsider, the product of incest. worshippers of all that is not God. We are Naomi, bitter and angry, disappointed and offended. But we have a choice. We can go to Romans 8:28 and we can say with Paul, we put this in some context now. Romans 8:28 says, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for the good of those who are called according to his purpose." All things includes bad things, not just the peachy good things. If you look at the context of 8:28, verse 17 says that the sufferings of this present age are not worth comparing. Verse 17 says that we will glorify those who we will be glorified with Christ if we suffer with him. Verse 18 says that the sufferings of this present age are not worth being compared to the glory that's coming. Verse 20 says the entire creation groans with him. That includes you and me as we are subject to futility. 21 says this whole creation is in bondage to decay. 22 says that spiritual Christians groan together with creation, awaiting our adoption as sons. 24 says that we are saved in hope because it's not real now. It's still in hope. It's coming. Verse 35 says that there's tribulation and distress and persecution and famine and nakedness and danger and sword. And in the middle of all of this is verse 28 that says all things work together. All things work together for the good of those that love God and are called according to his purpose. That's all things in your life and mine. And if we choose to wrap our hearts and our faith around this statement, we end up like Naomi, escaping the bitterness that traps us and being free to grow old, sweet, still telling the story of God till the day we land up in the grave. If you hear the gospel call from our heavenly Boaz, Jesus, and you receive the grace and the forgiveness of God, the bitterness you have towards him melts away. What about the cross? Acts 4, verse 27, "For truly in this city they were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." You know, it was the sin of Pilate, the sin of Herod, the sin of the Gentiles, the sin of the Jews that put Jesus on the cross. But it was the plan of God for our good that did it. What about Job? You know, Job lost everything. His family, his kids, his wealth, his health. He lost it all. And in Job 19, he's angry at God and he shouts out, "Tell it to God. He's the one who's behind all of this," raves Job. "He's the one who dragged me into this mess." Have you ever felt like shouting at God that way? "Look at me. I shout murder and I'm ignored. I call for your help and no one bothers to stop." And Job raves on, and then God suddenly answers him in chapter 38. "And now, finally, God answers Job from the eye of a violent storm, and he said, 'Why do you confuse the issues, Job? Why do you talk without knowing what you're really talking about? Pull yourself together, Job,' says God. 'Up on your feet, stand tall. I've got some questions for you. I want some straight answers from you, Job. Where were you when I created the earth? Tell me, since you know so much. Who decided on its size? Certainly you should know that. Who came up with the blueprints and the measurements? Who was there when the foundations were poured and who set the cornerstone while the morning stars sang in chorus and all the angels shouted praise? Who took charge of the oceans when it gushed forth like a baby from the womb? It was me, Job. I wrapped it in soft clouds and tucked it away safely at night.'" God goes on, he confronts Job directly in chapter 40. "Now what do you have yourself to say for yourself now, Job?" says God. "Are you going to haul me, the mighty one, into court and press charges?" Have you ever felt like that? You'd like to press charges against God for the lot that you've been dealt? And Job answers God. And he says, "God, I'm speechless and I'm in awe. Words fail me. I should never have opened my mouth. I've talked too much, way too much. I'm ready to shut up and listen." He says later on, After God comes back to him with more questions, Job says in chapter 42, I'm convinced you can do God, you can do anything and everything. Nothing and no one can upset your plans. You asked, who is this muddying the waters, ignorantly confusing the issue, second-guessing my purposes? I admit I was the one. I babbled on about things far beyond me, made small talk about wonders that were way over my head. And you told me, listen, let me do the talking. Let me ask the questions. You give the answers. I admit I once lived on rumors of you. Now I have it all firsthand. From my own eyes and ears, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again, I promise. I'll never live on crusts of hearsay or crumbs of rumor. When crisis hits and you're navigating a hairpin bend in your life, you cannot afford to live on hearsay rumors of what God is like. You cannot live on crusts and crumbs. You have to go back and say, God, you are almighty. You do as you please, when you please, with whom you please, without any pressure to provide explanation or excuse. And you are amazingly good and kind. And you faithfully provide. Can we stand speechless? My prayer for this morning was, where you've gotten caught in bitterness towards God because your life hasn't turned out the way you dreamed it would, can you be like Job and say, I'm ready to listen, to shut up and listen and humble myself and worship, rather than feel like I'm going to take God to court like Naomi would have liked to? When she saw the kindness of God in Boaz, when we discover the kindness of God in Jesus, in this field that we just happen to find ourselves gleaning in, bitterness disappears. And there rises up within us an engaged and active and scheming, working, taking initiative, dreaming man or woman ready to tell God's story and learn your lines and glorify His name with all of your life. We're going to stand and we're going to take communion together. So if we can hand out the elements, that would be great. And I want you to remember, let's stand together. I want you to remember as you take these elements that you didn't find Him. That nothing you did warrants the field that you just happened to find yourself in this morning. God, in His kindness and goodness, has brought you here. And the elements you hold in your hand are a reminder of your heavenly Boaz's goodness and kindness and provision for you. The cup that you'll drink this morning is so sweet. And you know why? Because the bitter one was drunk by Him. We drink the sweetness. And as Naomi's bitterness gave way to a beautiful sweetness again in her old age, my prayer is that the bitterness that is in our hearts towards God would give way to sweetness again as we are reminded of Boaz's coming to you and choosing you to be kind to. Find a family member, find a friend. Don't do this alone. Take hands with somebody. Pray with somebody. Where there's a need to say, God, I'm through with my questions. I'm through with my ranting and raving and blaming of you. I'm through with shouting that I went away full and I've come back empty. I'm through with being bitter. Would you sweeten my life once again with the sweetness of this cup? Would you remind me, God, of your kindness towards me, and that all things, good and bad, work together for my good. Would you help me, God, with the rest of my life to tell your story, to be a witness of your grace, of your kindness, of your forgiveness. Would you help me dream again? Would you help me scheme again? Would you fill my heart with faith again and a sense of optimism, Father, because of your kindness and your sovereignty over our lives? Let's worship as we take communion together.